and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of last night's Univision Washington Post Democratic presidential debate in Florida aimed at the Latino vote, which to a large extent dealt with immigration. Martha Aravello, the executive director of the Central American Resource Center, CARACEN, who specializes in immigration advocacy work, community outreach, and Latino strategic communications, joins us to discuss how both Sanders and Clinton handled the questions in Spanish from an undocumented native from Guatemala whose husband had been deported, leaving her and her children to fend for themselves. We'll also examine the unsafe criminal and political environment in Central America that drives immigrants north, recently made clear by the assassination of the Honduran human rights and environmental activist Berta Cáceres. Then we'll get an analysis of President Obama's explanation and defense of his foreign policy in a lengthy article by Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic from Shibley Telhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, who recently served as a senior advisor to the U.S. Department of State. We will discuss Obama's frank criticism of allies who are free riders on defense and his aversion to greater U.S. involvement in the Middle East. Then finally, with North Korea now under severe sanctions that cut off supplies of jet and rocket fuel, we will examine whether trying to punish the North Korean regime further for its missile and nuclear tests will ever get Kim Jong-un to give up his crown jewels, a growing, if antiquated, nuclear arsenal. Bennett Ramberg, who was a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs at the State Department, joins us to discuss his article at Reuters, "It May Be Time to Return U.S. Nukes to the Korean Peninsula," and the need to try a different approach to the North Koreans by stop trying to threaten them, but start talking to them. And joining us now is Martha Aravello, who is an executive director of the Central American Resource Center, CARACEN, since 2012. She specializes in immigrant advocacy work, community outreach, and Latino strategic communications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Martha Aravello.
Thank you so much.
And what was your impression of the debate last night, the Univision Washington Post debate, where there was actually a very powerful moment where a woman from a native of Guatemala speaking in Spanish explained to both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders that her husband had been deported and that she was sort of left here to fend for herself with her children. And of course, both candidates weighed in on how immoral it was, this policy, which Hillary Clinton was forced to defend. What was your sense of that moment? Because I thought that was a very powerful moment. And who do you think equip themselves best in terms of dealing with U.S. policy in regard to the fate of this woman and her children?
Well, I think you're very right. I think that whenever we can talk about the human impact of these deportation policies and what it has done to our community in terms of, you know, bring terror and fear in our community every day where families are being separated, like this woman from Guatemala. You know, this is the real stories that are happening every single day that we see in our work every single day where children are left without parents, where wives are left without husbands, and where policies and the policymakers and the administration really focus on the numbers and on the divisive politics in Washington, D.C., and forget that these are human beings that are being torn apart in our communities every day. I think that the candidates, it was great to see that they were now faced with the human pain and suffering that is happening all the time. I think that Hillary Clinton has been a candidate that has supported the Obama administration's policies of deportation, who has supported deporting unaccompanied children, and that's unfortunate. And I think that she was put in a very defensive position of having to defend those type of stances. I think it was great to see that there's been some shift in her position on these policies. And she had expressed that now she would be willing to support unaccompanied children and would not want to support the deportation of these children. So I think that that was really, really good to see. I think that Senator Sanders has been an ongoing supporter of unaccompanied children and had spoken and criticized the Obama administration on this issue. And he has said publicly over and over again that he believes that deporting and separating families is wrong for this country. And so I was glad to see him also being able to reconfirm that commitment to the immigrant communities.
So I've been asked many times, Martha, why it is that the same administration that has attempted to, through executive order because of obstruction from the Congress, to deal with this crisis of immigrants coming from largely from Central America, many of whom were unaccompanied children, which, as you know, have been blocked by the courts. But mm-hmm. it's as though if once Obama is blocked by the courts, he then sort of deports people with a vengeance. There's a bifurcation there that's hard to understand.
Yes, there's definitely been a contradiction in terms of somebody who has supposedly supported immigrant communities and has supported and ran actually in terms of his 2008 and 2012 election on being the president that was going to be able to pass immigration reform and that, you know, focus on keeping families together. And at the same time is the president who has deported the most people in the history, close to 3 million people, many of which, you know, are families like the woman in the debate that have been torn apart. It is a contradiction. It is something that has baffled our communities. Many of us supported him. Many of us voted for him. You know, we continue to have to fight with the Obama administration on this issue. DACA and DAPA are really deportation protection programs, nothing more. And those were won because of the community fighting every single day and going out there and putting pressure to the administration and other elected officials so that those programs could be put into place. Unfortunately, they're, you know, on hold in the courts. And I know that the Supreme Court will hold a hearing in April. And we're hoping that we'll have the opportunity to implement these programs that could potentially bring some sense of security to these, you know, thousands of families that live in fear every day. But I think you're right. It's a contradiction, and we need to continue to bring, a voice forward and loud and clear that the Obama administration has really gone back on his word in protecting these families.
Again, I'm speaking with Martha Arevalo, who is the executive director for the Central American Resource Center, CARACEN. She specializes in immigrant advocacy work, community outreach, and Latino strategic communications. So in terms of, though, what drives people to head north with tremendous personal risk, having to go through Mexico where they're hunted and robbed and raped, etc., finally making it here, and then, of course, facing deportation and the breaking up of families, etc., which we've been discussing. So let's turn to what is driving. We know that there's tremendous insecurity, particularly amongst young people in El Salvador because of gangs. And also, recently, this assassination of this defender of indigenous rights, Bertha Carasas, in Honduras, that highlights the insecurity in general in Honduras with the criminal gangs, drug gangs, and a corrupt and somewhat illegitimate government. Mm-hmm. So just walk us through that real dimension, which seems to be the last thing we talk about. It's like the war on drugs, you know, magically there's no organized crime here. It's all the problem on the other side of the border. But mm-hmm. we're also very much a part of the problem in Honduras, I think, in the sense that we sanctioned this government that is clearly corrupt and may well have their fingerprints on this assassination.
You know, the relationship and influence and policy impact of the United States in the Central American region is nothing new. I myself am a result, a migrant who came here when I was 11 years old in the 1980s as a result of civil war in El Salvador, where the United States played a critical role both in terms of its foreign policy impact in the region for decades and decades, and its military aid to corrupt governments year after year during the war. And that influence and impact has continued in the region. The fact that we have had such aggressive deportation policies have really cost and exacerbated the gang problem in countries countries like El Salvador. A lot of those gang members were deported and therefore brought that gang element to the country. The war on drugs has significantly affected the region, an already very fragile and poor region, where the drug traffickers move from Caribbean routes through the Caribbean, you know, islands and an ocean to the Central American region, where the Northern Triangle is very much now the new routes for a lot of the drug trafficking. And the United States is the biggest consumer of the drugs that are being trafficked. So, when you ponder these issues, you think about how can we try to put the enforcement piece of trying to stop the drug trafficking if we're not really investing and taking responsibility in terms of the demand for the drugs. And the people that are suffering, the people that are being affected by these policies, are families, women and children in the Central American region and Mexico, that are really kind of living that day-to-day war, and are the victims of that. In great part, in the Northern Triangle, children and women are by and large the biggest victims, and it really has caused a refugee crisis that the United States has very much some responsibility in it, because it's foreign and domestic policies that have greatly affected that region. And now we find ourselves with these crises of unaccompanied children and women and children refugees. Instability and insecurity in the region is an all-time high. El Salvador and Honduras go back and forth in terms of being number one in the world in terms of violence in an area that is not in the middle of a war. But El Salvador very recently just, was named the most violent country in the world, and Honduras just a year before, particularly against children. People that are defenders of human rights and defenders of indigenous rights and of climate change and environmental justice, like Berta Cáceres, have also been targeted for many, many, many years. She has, her and many who are working in that area and in that region have continued to receive death threats by death squads, and now resulted on the, incredibly sad and tragic murder assassination of Berta Cáceres, where potentially the biggest culprit and guilty party is the government itself, a government that has been supported by the United States, by Secretary Clinton. And so it really leaves very little trust that an assassination like of Berta Cáceres will, result in finding the real responsible parties. But it really is also an opportunity to continue to bring attention to the issues that Berta gave her life for, and the issues that the people of Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala and Central America and Mexico are suffering every day. Climate change is a big issue of why the migration is happening as well. NAFTA and CAFTA are big issues of why, these regions are so vulnerable and so fragile and so exploited by international interests and corporations that are exploiting the environment of these countries and really are doing it with impunity. There really isn't any law and order that is protecting the rights of the people that live in that region.
Well, I thought that things were changing in terms of the oligarchical power, that, for example, the 13 families that have run El Salvador forever. But it does seem that in Honduras, the oligarchs have been seizing rivers, plantations, mining lands, and this is what Berta was fighting against. After all, got the Goldman Environmental Prize. She wasn't exactly – she was a very high-profile person. And the fact that they so brazenly murdered her in her home and wounded the Mexican activist Gustavo Castro gives me a sense that they have this sense of impunity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If they can do this to somebody like Berta Cáceres, who really had – the world watching and the world interested in the region and the work that she was doing, you can only imagine what is happening every day to common people, common children and women and indigenous communities. And so it is definitely is a sad statement in terms of the state of affairs in the region and in Honduras. And I think that it's important that the United States pay attention, the world pay attention, and really try to examine its role in what is happening in the region and really can hopefully receive enough pressure to begin to be a real partner to the region to make sure that we are addressing the root causes, you know, causes of climate change and unfair trade agreements and, you know, violence and criminalization of its people.
Well, I think that's the point, though, isn't it? Just in closing, Martha, that if a prominent person like Berta can be assassinated, the ordinary person has absolutely no security, and therefore they must flee north. They must search for safety for themselves and their children.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, this is what's happening in the Central American region and in Mexico. This refugee crisis that we're seeing, mostly affecting children and women and children, is also part of a global refugee problem and crisis. We're seeing it in the Middle East. You know, we're seeing it in Africa. We're seeing it in so many regions throughout the world, and we really need to, as a very powerful nation that has so much say in how these global issues are addressed, really need to pay attention, and we really need to decide what kind of nation we want to be. If we want to be a nation of hate and intolerance, or we want to be a nation of compassion and respecting human rights. And the first step that we can do is pay attention to a humanitarian and refugee crisis that we have in our own region, in our own borders. We don't have to look very far to find that crisis. And unfortunately, the United States, our elected officials in an election year, we're not showing that we are a country of compassion and respecting human rights. So from the community perspective, we have to continue to fight for social justice. We need to continue to fight for refugee rights. We need to continue to fight to make sure that people are treated with compassion.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Martha Arevalo.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Martha Arevalo, who's the Executive Director of the Central American Resource Center, CARACEN. She specializes in immigrant advocacy work, community outreach, and Latino strategic communications. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back with an analysis of President Obama's explanation and defense of his foreign policy.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Shibley Tilhami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He serves as an advisor to the U.S. mission to the UN and to the Iraq Study Group, and is a member of the Strategic Environmental Group, and more recently as a senior advisor to the Department of State. His best-selling book is The Stakes, America and the Middle East, and his latest is The World Through Arab Eyes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shibley Tilhami.
My pleasure, as always.
And this long interview that Jeffrey Goldberg did with the President Obama that's now in The Atlantic, it's quite an extraordinary insight into the president's thinking, both in terms of his defense of his foreign policy and his explanation for it. And it's pretty surprising it's coming out before the end of his term, in as much as, for example, he accuses a lot of the America's closest allies are being freeloaders and singles out David Cameron in that regard for criticism. What did you think of it?
Well, it was remarkably revealing. Those are the sort of things that presidents do after the fact. We knew a lot about the president already. We knew a lot about how he sees international relations, the use of power, the Middle East, what sort of things in history have influenced him, his worldview. So much of that didn't surprise me particularly. This is what I understood about the president and his worldview. But what was really interesting is how frank the president was and how explicit he was in analyzing his thinking on Syria, on Russia's role, on the role of China, on Arab allies or Arab leaders and his anger with their postures or domestic policies, his view of the Saudis and Iran, his thinking about European allies. For sure, he said the sort of things that typically are not said, to the same extent at least, by a sitting president. So in that sense, it was revealing and surprising.
Well, little wonder he's wanted to tilt towards Asia and get out of the Middle East, based upon what he told Jeffrey Goldberg on Air Force One en route to Kuala Lumpur for a summit. Just to quote, "Right now, I don't think anybody can be feeling good about the situation in the Middle East. You have countries that are failing to provide prosperity and opportunity to their people. You've got a violent extremist ideology or ideologies that are turbocharged through social media. You've got countries that have very few civic traditions, so that as autocratic regimes start fraying, the only organizing principles are sectarian." And then he went on. Contrast that with Southeast Asia, which still has huge problems, enormous poverty, corruption, but it is filled with striving, ambitious, energetic people who are every single day scratching and clawing to build businesses and get education and find jobs and build infrastructure. The contrast is pretty stark. So for a specialist on the Middle East, that's pretty tough, isn't it?
Well, it's pretty tough, and of course a lot of it is true, meaning the Middle East is going through an extraordinary period in its history, and much of its future is not going to be dependent on what the U.S. will or will not do. But what was really interesting is that there is another side to the Middle East that the president didn't focus on, just the same energy that he sees in Asia, particularly among young entrepreneurs or inventors or economic drivers. You find a whole class of people in the Middle East, despite all of the trouble in particular countries, that are driving the economy, that are inventing, that are plugged into the world economy. So there is some energy in the Middle East, and it's actually in some ways not surprising the president isn't so much focused on it, because what he deals with on a daily basis is the crisis. And in that sense, I think the contrast is a bit exaggerated between the Middle East and parts of Asia.
But just to touch on the critical point, which he seems to be still very defensive about, the president, and that is the red line that the Assad regime allegedly crossed with the use of chemical weapons, that President Obama backed down from a promised strike, even though Secretary of State Kerry said it would be incredibly small, which was one of the strangest threats ever made in geopolitics. You wrote about it at the time, saying that it was a good thing that he'd be backed down. So just explain that and why the president is still defensive about it.
Well, let me just say that, you know, this has been an issue that has haunted the president, in part because Syria has obviously fallen apart. A lot of people thought that Assad was going to go. He didn't, and things deteriorated. And then obviously ISIS, which emerged in Iraq, expanded into Syria. And so there are lots of reasons why people have found fault in what's happening in Syria and blame the U.S. for it. The president did make mistakes in Syria. For example, I think when you say Assad must go and you are a superpower, people interpret that to mean that you have a policy to bring him down, not just that you make an intellectual statement of fact. And they expect, they rally behind you, they expect that you will be driving a policy. And I think that was not very well done. But having said that, I don't believe that he should have struck in Syria without UN support, without even European support, without even American public support, without congressional support, because it would had had it, did, it would not have made sense. How could you be acting in the name of international norms while going against international majorities? What norms are these that you would be defending when you're unable to muster international majorities that typically constitute the norms? If you are going, quote, in order to protect your credibility, what credibility? In the Middle East, the credibility is really about American aims, not about American actions. And people think America intervenes too much, not too little. So what credibility would the U.S. have, you know, have done? And if you add to that the fact that the CIA had told the president two things that had to weigh in heavily. Number one, that while there was evidence that Assad used chemical weapons, quote, as the article says, this was not a slam dunk case. And, you know, clearly we remember what happened with the Iraq weapons case in the case of the Bush administration intervention. And number two, that the president was being told by the CIA and all the national security advisors that whatever happens in Syria, if the Assad army collapses, it will be the Islamist, the extremist groups that would take place. And so he obviously, number one, didn't want to bring down the Syrian army. Number two, he could not have targeted the chemical weapons anyway. Number three, he didn't have international support for it. And number four, even if he had carried out some missile attacks, they would not have had consequence for the outcome of the war. And all they have, that would have generated was anger and the ability of Assad to say that he survived even America's attack. So I think it was the right thing to do, and he should not have put himself in a position where there was some expectation for him to act. Now, obviously, the president wants to use this to say that this was an issue that helped get the Russians to make the proposal that they ultimately did to eliminate Syrian chemical weapons. And we ended up with a happy outcome, meaning that, in fact, through peaceful means, Syria, with Russian support and the U.S. working with Russia and the international community, managed to get to put an end to Assad's chemical weapons. That would not have happened with the military intervention. And if the president wants to take credit for it, meaning the very threat that he might use force may have encouraged the Russians to put that proposal on the table, then fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But I don't see the failure to act against Assad as a failure. I think had we acted in that environment, given the lack of international support, given the lack of UN support, given the lack of American public support, given the fact that the strategy would have been merely punitive with no real consequences, I think it was not a failure. And on that, I agree with the president 100%.
And again, I'm speaking with Shibli Talhami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He served as an advisor to the U.S. mission, to the UN, the Iraq Study Group, and as a member of the Strategic Environment Working Group, and recently as a senior advisor to the Department of State. Of course, the CIA were quite correct in having their doubts about Assad's fingerprints on that chemical attack, because it's now becoming clear that the intelligence service in Turkey, the MIT, have perhaps supplied sarin to the rebels to basically entrap the U.S. into acting.
I don't know that for sure, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, I think we hear rumors and reports one way or the other. I don't know the facts, but I think the what we do know is there were some evidence, obviously, that the U.S. had. The president would not have acted if he had absolutely no evidence, but it was not slam-dunk evidence, and that was the point. And,
right.
And therefore, it left open the possibility that someone else may have done it. And frankly, even at that time, the biggest issue for those of us who are watching, and we don't know what the evidence is, and we don't really know how slam dunk it is. The biggest issue was, why would Assad really use that? It's not that he's not capable of. We've seen him kill a lot of innocent people. He's a ruthless dictator. But why would he want to use chemical weapons, which when he had the upper hand using conventional weapons, we've seen what he's done, been able to do without chemical weapons. Why would he want to get the anger of the international community against him using them? That has never really been explained. So the very logic of his using it is still problematic, and that probably added to the case that the CIA had that this was not a slam dunk evidence.
Well, the one area where, and of course the reason we're talking about this is this has been the kind of fixture on the part of the Republicans and much of the criticism that Obama has been getting during this these presidential debates from both sides. But the long and the short of it is there is some reason, I think, to be critical of the handling of Iraq, not in the way that Jeb Bush and others made the ludicrous charge that somehow it was Obama's fault that the U.S. pulled out. They pulled out according to George W. Bush's agreement that he'd signed. But the real fault, from what I understand, and there's one senior advisor to the U.S. who's an Iraqi-American who's been there throughout the entire period, who has also singled the president out for criticism in this regard, and that is that they didn't stick with Alawi when he won the elections, and they allowed that dreadful Maliki to come back, and we know what that's resulted in.
All right. Let me tell you something. And I've watched these very closely. This is an issue I've written about, and as you know, I've written a couple of books related to aspects of this issue, both in terms of, I opposed the Iraq War. I wrote a book opposing the Iraq War before it happened. And I certainly warned about the mess that would follow. But look, you know, one reason why I was worried is that when you get into a war like that and you bring down a government, an institution, in this case even the military institution, the ruling party, in a large country that is very diverse with known sectarianism, you are not going to be in the best position to make the right judgments about what to do. You're going to make mistakes. You are not going to get it right. You simply are not going to get it right. So, yes, there were mistakes. Bush made mistakes. Obama made mistakes. Those mistakes may have had some impact on the margin. But the reality was that the war itself and the disintegration of the state of Iraq made it so challenging and complicated and close to being a Humpty Dumpty that even with the smartest leadership and the most informed decisions, it was improbable that we're going to put the place back together in an effective way. So, yes, they made mistakes, but no, those are not where the responsibility lies for the outcome that we are seeing in Iraq and obviously next door in Syria.
Well, of course, we've never had a kind of truth and reconciliation investigation. The British have had one, and that is because they've left us open to this kind of demagogic criticism. But ironically, of course, the person who has been the most effective critic of those who really are responsible for this disaster, which is those who brought us into it in the first place, ironically, has been Donald Trump.
Yes, I mean, Trump has been a very interesting force because it tells you something when someone who is a leading Republican candidate in the middle of an establishment that is still relatively positive about the Iraq War and blames mostly the President Obama for the consequences, that he takes on the orthodoxy and finds that there is resistance in public, even among Republicans. That's a fascinating story. And that tells you something about the public's the public is being taken for granted, that this narrative is being shaped by elites who are trying to protect their actions. They're trying to protect their backs. They're trying to protect their legacies. And that has become a problem, and it's become very difficult to have that kind of analysis in American foreign policy, because both Democrats and Republicans want to be able to come back and go on, and so we don't find that historical assessment that is required, particularly with episodes that have been disastrous for our country, for the world, as has been the case with the Iraq War.
So, Shibli Talhami, back to the extraordinary interview that Jeffrey Goldberg recorded with the president over many, many, many meetings. It's pretty clear, isn't it, that Obama wanted, chose his vehicle to go on the record early.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that he obviously sees in him someone who is listened to by certain elites that are important in America, and he sends a message through him. Atlantic has become a good forum for that. He obviously also often speaks to Tom Friedman about issues of this sort, another favorite of the president on foreign policy issues, particularly related to the Middle East. But I do think that the more interesting question is not about the venue, but really why the president chooses to do this. And obviously now we're in the middle of a legacy battle, and people are trying to shape the president's own legacy for him, how he wants to be remembered. There's a war of narrative that is a function of our presidential campaign, and not so much in terms of how the GOP candidates are framing the issues, that I think isn't the battle, but even as the Democratic candidate, the winning Democratic candidate, whoever that might be, and particularly if it's Hillary Clinton, is going to move to the center. And at this point, she's writing on Obama's legacy domestically, because that's getting her a lot of the base support for the Democratic Party, to the point that someone remarked she's acting as though her name is Hillary Rodham Obama. And it's true, but I think as the campaign heats up and she starts moving to the center, she's going to be more critical of the administration on them, at least theoretically, at least in terms of what she might do, whether it's with regard to Syria, with regard to Iran, for political reasons. And I think the president probably wants to preempt that he wants to have his legacy interpreted by him. And so it goes very much against the conventional interpretation in our discourse that analysts have been trying to portray. And I have to tell you that I'm more on his side than not on this, that I do think that the U.S., the problems that are in the Middle East are not at the core about America, that America doesn't have the tools to get them right, and certainly not through military intervention, and that even when we intervene for humanitarian reasons, as may have been the case in our thinking in Syria, the next morning people will say you're doing it for imperialistic reasons and you're going to become more of a liability than an asset.
Well, Shibli Talhami, I appreciate your time and I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Shibli Talhami. He's the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He served as an advisor to the U.S. mission to the UN and on the Iraq Study Group, and as a member of the Strategic Environment Working Group, and recently as a senior advisor to the Department of State. He's author of the bestseller, The Stakes, America and the Middle East, and his latest book is The World Through Arab Eyes. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether it's time to stop trying to threaten the North Koreans, but start talking to them.
An empire, the newborn of the hammock rocks, below a bolted sky that unlocks. for the departing of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate liar.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole list truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bennett Ramberg, who was a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs at the Department of State during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author of Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy, an Unrecognized Military Peril. And he has an article at Reuters, It May Be Time to Return U.S. Nukes to the Korean Peninsula. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bennett Ramberg.
Thank you, Ian.
And obviously, the nukes were taken out of the Korean Peninsula and South Korea when the Cold War wound down in 1991. And already the Chinese are alarmed at this anti-missile system called THAAD that the U.S. is talking about deploying in South Korea. The Koreans are making noise about going nuclear. All of this would indicate to me that the Chinese have a real decision on their hand, don't they? Do they want to rein in North Korea, or do they want Japan and South Korea to go nuclear, or have the United States deploy nuclear weapons in South Korea again?
Well, the Chinese are stuck in a petard how to handle this particular issue. Certainly, they don't want nuclear weapons in South Korea. This is a decision the South Koreans, the U.S., would have to make. And I, frankly, even though I suggested this in my article as an option, I did so because the South Koreans have spoken about it not only now, but multiple times in the past. In fact, there was long ago an effort by the South Koreans to develop their own nuclear weapons program. But for the Chinese, they're stuck in this unusual situation. They want to preserve the North Korean regime. The North Korean regime is obstreperous. It continues to test nuclear weapons and the missile capacity to deliver them. And the question is how to rein them in while preserving the regime so their borderland with North Korea remains what it is. You have a friendly country, a relatively friendly country, on the border, albeit it's a problematic country. And so the Chinese have agreed to UN sanctions recently. Some of the sanctions are in principle, onerous. The question is, will the Chinese actually apply them? And that's an open question, frankly.
But if China's concerned about having a failed state on its border or a collapse in North Korea, which I understand is what bothers them, if you put even meaningful sanctions on, you're likely to bring about a collapse, aren't you?
Well, the question is how meaningful these sanctions will be and how to what degree will the Chinese prop up the regime. Now, the new UN sanctions are somewhat onerous. They're more onerous than they were in the past. They cut off, for example, jet fuel and rocket fuel to the North Koreans. The jet fuel, of course, is vital for the North Koreans' civil air force, aviation. So it's a challenge for the North Korean to adapt to this. But there are other questions as to whether the Chinese themselves actually will apply the sanctions. And there's those who say no. They will feign application. They might, to a degree, apply some, but not all the sanctions uttered in the recent Security Council resolution, which came out, I believe it was March 2nd.
And that came in response to the latest North Korean nuclear test and missile test.
Yes, the North Koreans tested nuclear weapon. They called it a a hydrogen bomb, which we don't believe it was. In January, then they initiated a rocket test. In February, the rocket test, however, was a liquid fuel rocket. However, no doubt the North Koreans could acquire some information from that rocket test to facilitate their development of an ICBM.
But in general, though, the real question is, once you go nuclear in this impoverished state that is often called the Hermit Kingdoms because it's so cut off from the rest of the world, as people have been starving now for decades, it's prepared to invest so much in a nuclear program. It's got nuclear weapons now. There's no way in the world that they're going to give up their crown jewels, are they?
No, I don't believe there's any way. So I think it's a quixotic policy the United States has been pursuing. Our policy, at least stated by this administration and frankly past administrations, has been to negotiate a deal with the North Koreans whereby they would get rid of their nuclear weapons capacity. And in exchange, they would get some economic assistance. And even there was the possibility in 2005, 2007, that the United States would actually recognize North Korea or establish some sort of diplomatic liaison with the North Koreans. But the North Koreans persistently have cheated on every agreement they've entered into with regard to nuclear weapons. Going back to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, they were party to the treaty, and they violated the treaty, which forbids the acquisition of nuclear weapons.
So, of course, the U.S. did not sign a peace treaty at the end of the Korean War with the North Koreans. Is that the same logic that wouldn't have made any difference?
Well, I think it's best, if it was the best of all worlds, that we have some sort of diplomatic relationship with the North Koreans. Some liaison, as I put forward in the Reuters article. In earlier articles, I actually called for diplomatic relations and recognition of something we can't change. And something we can't change about this regime is the nuclear program. As you suggested, it's a crown jewel. I don't think it's going to give up the crown jewel. It provides an option to better defend the country, to provide deterrence, and to be more aggressive if they wish to be. You know, they're now a member of the Nuclear Weapons Club. They may not yet, however, have a deliverable nuclear weapon. There's open questions about this. They've been trying to miniaturize the weapon. It'll take still some time for them to go in that direction, but the presumption has to be that at some point they'll be able to mate a weapon to a rocket, and that rocket could pose a threat to South Korea and Japan. And because both countries are U.S. allies, this poses a problem to the United States. And in the long term, well, there's the risk that North Korea can mate a weapon with an intercontinental ballistic missile and pose a threat to the United States itself. So these are concerns any policymaker would have to address.
And again, I'm speaking with Bennett Ramberg, who was a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico and Military Affairs in the Department of State during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author of Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy, an Unrecognized Military Peril, and he has an article at Reuters, It May Be Time to Return U.S. Nukes to the Korean Peninsula. So I want to talk to you further about the idea that we should simply bite the bullet and start talking to these people. I mean, of course, that was the blindness, if you will, of the Axis of Evil speech that took place during George W. Bush's administration, where the very countries we've had problems with, Iran, Iraq, and North Korea, were all put on this list of the Axis of Evil. And if you don't talk to people, you don't have any diplomatic relations, you don't have particularly good intelligence about what's going on. So to some extent, you're creating your own black hole. So here we've had this black hole with North Korea since 1952. It would seem it's about time to shed some light, isn't it?
Well, optimally, but the United States has been in communication with North Korea, you know, beginning with the agreed framework during the Clinton administration, where an agreement was reached where the United States would provide civil nuclear reactors to North Korea some economic assistance if the North Koreans would halt their nuclear program, suspend it, halt it, get rid of it. At the end, however, of the Clinton administration, there was the first indications intelligence had uncovered that North Korea had a secret nuclear program, an enrichment program. And the Bush administration, when it came into office, they confronted the North Koreans. They said, aha, you've been cheating on this agreed framework. And you have this secret enrichment program. And as a consequence of that, the connection with North Korea collapsed, but was resurrected by the Bush administration. And you had what was called the six-party talks. And in the talks, there was South Korea, Japan, Russia, Chinese, the United States, North Korea. And there were efforts during those talks to reach an agreement. And there was an agreement reached in 2005 where the North Koreans agreed to get rid of their nuclear program. But they never did. They've agreed to this multiple times. When the United States in 1991 withdrew nuclear weapons from South Korea, these were legacy weapons from the Cold War, the South Koreans and the North Koreans entered into an agreement that would permanently denuclearize the peninsula. And the North Koreans subsequently violated it. So repeatedly they have violated agreements they've entered into with the South Koreans, with the six parties, with the United States, and on. So there's little confidence that the North Koreans will get rid of their nuclear program. In fact, it continues on, albeit slowly, glacially. I mean, they have limited engineering capacity, other capacities to develop this program, but nonetheless, they're developing or they continue to produce weapons-grade material, enriched uranium as well as plutonium, and there's no doubt they have a program in the process which at some point will provide them with a deliverable capability. How soon, that's uncertain. Whether they have a capacity today is subject to speculation. But it's a problem. So one of the issues I get into in this piece and others is it time to accept what we cannot change? Rather than try to isolate this country, this very, very paranoid country that can't see outward, maybe it's time to engage the country and accept the fact that it is a nuclear weapon state. However, if I may add, it comes with an additional problem. We don't want to encourage other countries to go down the same track. So if we accept North Korea as a nuclear-armed state in violation of its nuclear nonproliferation vows, what about other countries? What would the Iranians say in the future? You accepted North Korea? As such, you know, we feel that we're endangered as well. We have responsibilities to ourselves to better protect ourselves. And would that open the door for the Iranians or other countries to say, we're going to depart from the nuclear nonproliferation treaty to develop our own bomb, and we'll get the international community to accept ultimately, as they've accepted North Korea. Of course, that acceptance has not taken place. We would like to resume discussions with the North Koreans. The Chinese have called for resumption of those discussions. But frankly, the North Koreans are not going to give up their nuclear weapons program.
Well, they just put on display the other day in North Korea with Kim Jong-un standing beside this nuclear bomb. Apparently it was a mock-up, but it looked exactly like the plutonium core of the Fat Man, which was the plutonium bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki in 1945. It doesn't look like highly advanced miniaturized nuclear weapons by any stretch of the imagination. And when you talk about them being able to deliver a nuclear weapon, if these sanctions that are now being imposed on them sanction jet fuel, their jet fighters and bombers won't have the fuel to deliver. So this is an odd situation, isn't it, where they're making so-called advances in nuclear weapons, but in every other sense, they're being the door's being shut on them if China goes along with these sanctions.
Mind you, it also includes sanctions or prohibitions on provision of rocket fuel, and no doubt this will put a crimp on North Korea's capacity to fly aircraft and to develop their rockets. Whether they have an indigenous capacity to generate these fuels, I'm uncertain. But again, going back to the Chinese, repeatedly the Chinese have made commitments to block North Korea's access to a variety of things. And the questions remain whether they'll honor this particular agreement. And it's at this point, it's something to assess as we go down, as we look to the future. It's uncertain. Mind you, these new sanctions have only gone into effect as of March 2nd. So we'll have to see what happens as we look forward. Mm.
And also just in terms of how antiquated the North Koreans are, even if they have nuclear weapons, it do seem to be sort of going back to almost to the Fat Man of 1945, which is the first or the second bomb ever created. You know, the fact that their rockets are liquid fuel, which, you know, is another antiquated technology. In general, this is the sort of the tyranny of the weak we're talking about here. My understanding is that North Korea's greatest Achilles heel is that their people are living in a cocoon where they're spent from cradle to grave. They're indoctrinated with worshipping the boy emperor and his family. But when the balloons come over and VCRs, videos get played on VCRs, they see that the conditions in the South are quite different from what they're told. And in general, when you open up a country diplomatically and start having engagement, then the whole, you know, the walls start to crumble, as they did at the end of the Cold War. So doesn't it make more sense at the end of the day? We've tried being tough with these people, and all it does is have them dig in their hands and become even more militarized, if that's possible. So why not try something different?
Well, I totally agree. I mean, if it would be possible, for example, to have diplomatic relations with the North Koreans, more foreigners entering the country, more trade relations with the North, this would open up the country, to expose them to the broader world, mind you. There are, among the North Korean leadership, people who are aware of the world outside. Kim Jong-un himself, of course, studied as a teenager in Switzerland. But nonetheless, the more folks that are exposed, the better it is. and the greater the possibility that in time this would have an impact on the regime. So I'm given the circumstance where we can't squeeze them to the point they're going to give up the nuclear weapon. I think the point now is to accept what we cannot change, and as a consequence, hope that this new direction would be the way to open up the country and in time undermine the country as well.
Well, you know, Donald Gregg, who's a former senior CIA officer, and he was the U.S. ambassador to South Korea. I've spoken to him a number of times. He goes to North Korea a lot, very engaged with their leadership and at all levels, and is absolutely, you know, spends all his time trying to get the U.S. government to take the North Koreans seriously and talk with them. So, you know, it's obviously there's a lot of resistance on this side.
Yes, there is a lot of resistance because, you know, frankly, when you look at things from a non-proliferation point of view, any acceptance of a country like North Korea with a nuclear weapon is contrary to all we've strived for to try to minimize the spread of nuclear weapons. And so we simply don't want any additional precedent. But this rubs against the fact that the North Koreans already have the capacity. But going back to your point, there's some questions whether they have a deliverable capacity at this point in time. But we have to conclude that in time, the North Koreans, with more nuclear tests, more efforts, will be able to miniaturize their weapon and place it on a missile that could be delivered to the South and Japan, at least in the short run, and pose challenges for the United States. There's another problem as well with this program. The North Koreans could export elements of the program, and we've already seen this. They exported effectively a weapons reactor to Syria in the 2000s. It's a reactor the Israelis destroyed in 2007. And the questions arise, will the North Koreans, which will sell anything to anybody, would they sell nuclear material? Would they sell a nuclear weapon? In this world of terrorism, we have to be, of course, concerned about this. And there's been speculation about their relationship with Iran. They've had a close relationship with regard to missile development, and the North Koreans have spent a lot of time developing their missile capacity, and they provided the Iranians with the benefits of that development. And the question has arisen, since you've had reportedly Iranians at the test site when they've tested nuclear weapons, whether the North Koreans could actually assist the Iranians at some point in time with their own nuclear weapons ambitions.
All the more reason to engage them then, right?
I would think that would be my preference. We have to understand we're not going to change the reality that they have this nuclear capacity, and I think the time has come to become real, let's put it that way.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Bennett.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Bennett Ramberg, who was a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs at the Department of State during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author of Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy and Unrecognized Military Peril. And he has an article at Reuters, It May Be Time to Return U.S. Nukes to the Korean Peninsula. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast and also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.